Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. We speak with Jeff Bartos, a student at Central Connecticut State University and co-founder of Connecticut's IVAW office. That's Iraq Veterans Against the War. IVAWCT co-founder Chris Groves has worked as a media activist at WHUS in Storrs, Connecticut. And these friends from high school, who were both deployed to Iraq and in Chris's case also to Afghanistan, are now activists working to end U.S. occupation and war in Iraq and Afghanistan. We will also hear from student organizer Denisa Yashari, a senior at Trinity College in Hartford, and she'll talk about a peace march she and other Connecticut students will go to in Boston on October 17th. On September 20th in Hartford, Connecticut's Bushnell Park, Connecticut IVAW member Chris Groves talked about his group's efforts as he introduced journalist Dar Jamail, author of the 2009 book The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan.
I just want to speak to the importance of independent media based on my own experiences in Iraq, just being there, being fed the corporate media line, which is just straight out of the Pentagon. You're there, you're seeing what's going on, you realize that everything is wrong, but you just don't know what to do about it. And that's something CNN, everyone else in the corporate media is not going to feed you. another option of what you can do. And I know as far as myself, when I came back, just listening to independent media greatly changed my views, solidified everything into a coherent picture, and that's why I'm here today. And what Dar was saying, asking what you can do with IVAW, well, here in Connecticut, right now, there's basically two of us. We have more members, but their lives are even busier than the two of ours. So it's just two of us doing this. So we just need help spreading the word to veterans who do share our views on the two conflicts to just get in touch with us. I have the contact information at the table. We just need more people right now.
You can contact Chris Groves' group at Connecticut at IVAW.org. Their website is IVAW.org/Connecticut. Now, Dar Jamail.
I just want to start with reading a real brief quote from the first conscientious objector to the current occupation of Iraq, Camilo Mejia. Most of you, I imagine, have probably heard of him. He actually stood up, publicly refused to redeploy after being in Iraq and being in a lot of combat, and ended up spending 9 months in a military brig as a result of his court-martial, and then was actually classified as a prisoner of conscience by Amnesty International while he was in the brig, as happens with most GI resistors now. And he wrote an essay called Regaining My Humanity, and I just want to quote from his essay. I say without any pride that I did my job as a soldier. I commanded an infantry squad in combat, and we never failed to accomplish our mission. But those who called me a coward, without knowing it, are also right. I was a coward not for leaving the war, but for having been a part of it in the first place. Refusing and resisting this war was my moral duty, a moral duty that called me to take a principled action. I failed to fulfill my moral duty as a human being, and instead I chose to fulfill my duty as a soldier. All because I was afraid. I was terrified. I did not want to stand up to the government and the army. I was afraid of punishment and humiliation. I went to war because at the moment I was a coward, and for that I apologize to my soldiers for not being the type of leader I should have been. And I think that's really the spirit of all the folks that I talked to and all the folks today, that actually so much has happened just since this book's come out, that it's been hard for me to even try to keep up with it as far as how many soldiers are starting to refuse orders to deploy, not just to Iraq, but now to Afghanistan.
Joining us now, Jeffrey Bartos. He was a sergeant in the U.S. military and, like Chris Groves, who we heard earlier, also a medic. Jeffrey, welcome.
Thank you.
Independent media has had headlines about your arrest recently at the G20. Let's start there. Just explain what happened in Pittsburgh.
I went to the G20 protest and gathering because I don't feel that the power of the people should be left in the hands of 20 finance ministers and other government officials. So I went there to work as a marked street medic for the protesters because they don't often have immediate access to first aid when they're caught in the middle of a protest.
When you went to the protest, did you anticipate that the police presence would be as big as it was?
Well, the previous night, both the Pittsburgh police, state police, and all their other contracted policemen from different states pretty much invaded the University of Pittsburgh campus. They were tear gassing and pepper spraying college students and activists alike. They used rubber bullets. There's a few arrests. So since this was a vigil against the same activity that happened the previous night, I anticipated there was going to be some cops. I didn't anticipate, like, what I'm guessing is over 1,000 of them.
1,000. And they were dressed for riot. I mean,
full riot gear, yes.
Now, the rioting wasn't going on. I mean, just talk about what happened when the tear gas and pepper spray began to come.
Yeah, there was no aggressive behavior on the part of the people out there for the vigil. The aggressive behavior came from the police department when they ordered everyone to disperse and everyone started making their way off as we were pretty much surrounded. And then they decided, I guess, we weren't dispersing quickly enough. And so they began motivating us with, they were pepper spraying people. They were using intimidating techniques like tapping their riot batons on their shields, other various methods. And the people that were the slowest, a couple journalists and other people, started getting pepper sprayed and tear gas.
What was happening to this person that you felt you needed to come to his aid with your medical care?
We had been pushed by the police line into this sort of a park near the University of Pittsburgh campus, and we had had to jump hedges to get in there. And the photojournalist that I was helping had jumped a hedge, and I think he was trying to get a few pictures of the police line coming through it, and they had pepper sprayed him rather badly. So he was being assisted up the hill by two of his other friends, and I just saw them pretty much dragging him, like he was in the shoulder carry, pretty much dragging him up the hill. So we moved to assist him and help flush out his eyes and moved him a little more. And at that point, we were surrounded and arrested.
And what happened to this person, do you know?
We only were able to flush out his eyes somewhat, but I'm pretty sure he was released without charges. I can't be sure about that. So I don't even know the guy's name.
You were released after a certain amount of time, longer than everybody else, right?
Yes, they decided that they wanted me to post bail, so they kept me in the State Correctional Institute for about 12 hours and then moved me to the Allegheny County Jail for another 5 or 6.
How long did you remain in handcuffs? Because the first press release I got was about the fact that you had these super tight handcuffs on.
When they initially arrested everyone, they were using the plastic zip-tie handcuffs, which mine were put on too tightly. I complained about several times. I was kept in those until from 11:30 at night till about 5:30 in the morning. I'm not sure on the last time because I couldn't see a clock or have a watch until I was changed into metal handcuffs. And then I was kept handcuffed for pretty much the entire day with a few brief exceptions, like to be fingerprinted and stuff, until about 6 p.m.
Did anyone ever explain to you why the handcuffs were necessary? I mean, you, the dangerous, you know, veteran of the U.S. military who is trained as a medic?
They kept pretty much everyone handcuffed. I think it was both an intimidation thing, so much easier to control someone in their handcuffs. Eventually, our handcuffs were moved around to the front, but it was still sort of a, hey, we're in control here, and it left very little room for any, I guess, funny business on the part of any of the other people that were arrested.
And so what has happened now? I know you had to go back down to Pittsburgh to answer some of the charges against you. Why don't you discuss what the case was against you, and then what happened next?
I was charged with failure to disperse and disorderly conduct, and there's currently a class action suit with the ACLU that they're suing the city of Pittsburgh for their heavy-handed tactics. I'm getting involved with that. I chose to perform 50 hours of community service with a nonprofit in exchange for my charges being dropped, and my record will be expunged to the arrest. But others are choosing to go back to Pittsburgh numerous times to just get a straight dismissal, hopefully, from their charges by the judge. I know the Pittsburgh DA is reviewing most all of the cases independently to see, like, which ones are valid and which are not. And a lot of the court appearances will be on October 21st or 23rd, I think.
How did the G20 fit in with your goals of addressing U.S. policy on Iraq and Afghanistan?
Recent opinion polls have shown that more than half, I think it was like 54% of population as opposed to further escalation and war in Afghanistan. And during his campaign and during his first few days in office, President Obama stated that he was going to start withdrawing combat brigades from Iraq, and I haven't heard of any motion towards that whatsoever. I haven't heard of any combat brigades being withdrawn or anything like that. And the escalation in Pakistan with the drone attacks on a sovereign nation's soil and other stuff, it's a direct mismatch of what the United States' policy is and what the will of the people is. I mean, most Americans don't want further escalation in Afghanistan. They don't want U.S. soldiers defending a little bit of dirt in a remote hilly region of Afghanistan. We're no longer fighting Al-Qaeda there. We're fighting a resurgence of the Taliban, which historically in that area of the world has defeated every empire that's invaded it.
What have your thoughts been as someone who's been deployed and who understands the military itself and how it really looks from a war zone? What are your thoughts about what these soldiers are being asked to do?
The thing about the Iraq war, there was no Al-Qaeda in Iraq when we invaded in 2003. Al-Qaeda came and actually formed independently of anything else in Iraq due to the United States invasion. The easiest way to create a terrorist is to kill their brother or kill their father or kill their mother or whatever. You alienate the local population by killing some of the people they love, and suddenly you have a bunch of angrier people that are now willing to defend their homeland from an outside threat, as opposed to a population that sees these people coming to provide whatever liberation or whatever you want to call it to them. So by the terrorism thing, right now we're fighting the Taliban, which is really just a new collection of the same people that fought the Soviets, that rebelled against the Taliban and have also kicked out the Russians, the British, and a few others.
Do you see any reason for U.S. forces to remain in terms of national security interests as discussed, you know, by American media pundits? I mean, there's always this discussion of, you know, we've got to stop them before they come here, or how do we protect ourselves against all this terrorism? Can you just respond to those kinds of questions?
Al-Qaeda and bin Laden have stated that the reason that they are anti-American is the occupation of their holy lands in Saudi Arabia, where U.S. interests have gone in and exploited the area for the oil, and now through the government of Saudi Arabia are attempting to control the Muslim holy land, and through the United States' support of Israel and their occupation of Palestine. So the way to keep people safe, per se, in America is to take a look at the fundamentals of our foreign policy and attempt to see how we can reconcile with the people that don't like us, as opposed to just moving on based off like what we think is good for America, move based off what we think is good for the world as a whole.
Jeff Bartos, I want you to talk about your service a little bit and what you saw while you were deployed and what you've learned about the military and the reality of things like stop loss, you know, the difficulties of soldiers who have been deployed, redeployed, and regardless of what they want now or what they even feel they can handle, are being redeployed.
Okay, well, I deployed in December of 2005 as a medic with the 4th Infantry Division. I did 8 months on patrols. We had a road to secure. We manned a few checkpoints, did some other stuff, monitored a few cultural areas. And I then spent another, on each end of that, I spent 2 months working in an aid station and saw all the normal war wounds and stuff that are less than fun to talk about. And I was serving with, I think, 3 people in my platoon of 18 that were stop lost and were supposed to be out of the military, and they were still being made to deploy to Iraq with us. So there was added stress on them. The suicide rate, I think we had one person successfully commit suicide and a few others attempt it when I was deployed. Drug abuse, all the other stuff that's just, it's a product of the stress that soldiers are put under by repeated deployment. I was almost subject to stop loss myself, but they moved the date back by 2 months, and I would have had to serve another 16 months. The people I deployed with that had to do got a year at home, which is more like 2 months at home, and then 10 months of training for another 16-month deployment. So I can't even imagine the kind of stress that those guys had to go through.
And you were deployed in Texas and other places, you know, always serving as a medic?
I spent about a year in Korea, and then I went to Fort Hood, Texas with the 4th Infantry Division, deployed for a year, and came back for another 6 months where I was discharged. There's medics with every sort of unit. I deployed deployed with an artillery unit, but they didn't really need artillery at that time, so we were subjugated onto patrolling.
What did you learn from Iraq about the way the U.S. military operates in war zones or during an occupation, and how did it contrast with the view you had when you left, and maybe with the view that Americans still have?
Well, I have one pretty poignant, anecdote for that. One of the villages we were responsible for monitoring at one point, there was this girl who had lost an eye from, I forget the exact reason, but as part of our whole Hearts and Minds campaign, we were attempting to get her to be transported to Baghdad to get a glass eye fitted and placed and all the other stuff that comes along with that. And it was just, great, going to make newspaper headlines, awesome humanitarian mission. But before we could get it undertaken, they decided that they were transferring the authority of those four or five sectors over to the Iraqi army. So the girl never received the treatment that we were promising, and I guess we lost the hearts and minds in that sector. The way the U.S. forces are operating is, at least when I was there, they're in a very limited, restricted role, which is usually good, but these are people that are trained from the moment they enter basic training to kill people, and you're asking them to act as a police force and a governing body in a notoriously divided area where, tribal and ethnic alliances reign supreme and not what some person with a gun says is going to happen.
You know, journalist Dar Jamail helped us understand how debathification and then all the bombing and the lack of reconstruction and water, electricity, the destruction of Fallujah, the mass arrests, all contributed to not only Iraqis supporting the resistance, but also the process of ethnic divisions.
Prior to the first Gulf War, the Iraqi people were the number one consumers of books in the Arabic world. And Baghdad was the place to send your children to college if you were an Arab. And now we've taken an enormously educated population. Most of them have university educations. Most of them speak multiple languages. Most of them are brilliant people, especially within the Ba'ath Party. That was like joining the Republican Party or whatever. If you wanted to have a government job, whether it was a teacher, a clerk, whatever, you joined the Ba'ath Party because that was the government. And so we've taken all these people, and when the CPA, I forget the exact acronym for it, I think Coalition Provisional Authority, took over, they eliminated the Ba'ath Party members from holding any government job in the new government. So you have all these highly educated people that are now unable to work because all the jobs are government. And you start getting the ethnic tension going on and a mass internal migration. And now you have a hugely educated population that no longer has a home or cannot go to their home because their neighbors who happen to follow a slightly different religious path are inclined to kill them based off U.S. governmental pressure, and you're stuck with an enormous humanitarian crisis. So you have all these idle people and no way to feed them, give them jobs, and all the other associated things that come with that.
Talk about what you're doing now and what your group does in terms of advocacy for soldiers or camaraderie, let's say, for those who have concerns about their service or who may need to not deploy, even though the military wants them to.
There isn't an enormous population of veterans in Connecticut, so our main outreach goal is to citizens of the state. For example, over the next few months, we're doing several screenings of the Brave New Films film, Rethink Afghanistan, in various locations across the state. There's one in Norwich, I think on the 19th of October. There's going to be one in West Hartford in November, I believe the second Tuesday, and one in Cornwall at some point. So we're going out to educate the citizens of Connecticut that, hey, the Afghanistan war is also not the greatest idea. You should probably call your representatives. You should start taking action to see if we can extricate our entire nation from this area. So if someone came across a veteran that needed some help or needed just someone to talk to, they could give me a call, and I'm available for that. Same thing with the other members of IBAW. It's like we're our own support network if need be.
Well, there is, of course, the GI Rights Hotline. It's been around for a while. Their number, 877-447-4487. Information soldiers need about their rights, health, the law, how to cope with loss of home or economic disaster, and all aspects of military service. You know, these are, in many cases, other veterans. And according to the Military Law Task Force, their phones are just ringing off the hook, with many people not knowing that there are, in fact, ways to avoid redeployment. We've also been hearing, though, that the force, the soldiers, are absolutely exhausted. That, of course, being reflected by the record suicide rates, this year again beating last year's horrific record. Just describe the condition of the forces that are in Iraq and Afghanistan as we look at this latest major deployment to Afghanistan.
Yeah, the choice to call the GRS hotline has to come from them. Like, you just have to make the information available and allow them the environment to where they can question things, be like, hey, will I be able to look at myself in the mirror if I go and do this? Will I feel morally and ethically right after if I have to go and do whatever I may be required to do in the service of what I'm doing it for? So a lot of people join up in the military with, like, a nationalistic pride. Personally, I joined out of reasons of patriotism and realized that what we were doing was not beneficial to the United States. So it's a matter of getting the information in the hands and letting them decide what they need to do with it. You can't force people to call your hotline. It's easy for one combat vet to talk to another about a bunch of the same things. Are they sleeping enough? Are they drinking too much? All the other stuff. Are they able to, like, are they seeing any, like, having any flat? It's relatively easy to discuss that in a one-on-one setting. Even the generals themselves have said, hey, our army is on the breaking point. But I think Donald Rumsfeld, when he was questioned about the necessity for better armor on the Humvees, said you go to the war with the army that you have. Right now, the army that they have is literally on the verge of falling apart from all the things you mentioned. The suicide rates, the drug abuse, the alcoholism, the post-traumatic stress disorder. And a lot of troops are being given prescriptions for antidepressants and being sent, redeployed, all the other stuff, because it's a huge stigma to be, no, I can't take it anymore. I need to stop. I need to get some help. So they're just getting the prescription for antidepressants, maybe going to a few counseling sessions, and then just repressing it further. As this affects them, this affects their family life who hasn't seen them, and their last memory is of this nice smiling guy 12 months ago who comes back and is now haunted. So it's hugely stressful on not just the soldier, on the family, and all the other stuff. So
I'd say the majority of soldiers I've met have had concerns about either their role or the role of the U.S. military in general. Although I have met one soldier who said he supports George Bush, and he was actually quite angry. Do you run into that, soldiers who are pro-war?
I met a few strongly pro-war soldiers, and the thing that I say to them, if they have deployed, I'm like, look, I'm glad you're back. I'm glad you're whole. We don't agree. But the thing is that you can support the troops without supporting the war, because you're supporting their right to come back and live out the rest of their life, not their right to go die in some desert or on a mountain pass or something for a limited political objective. You can support their right and their job and honor what they do in their protective role without saying that, hey, these wars are right. You can just be like, look, I understand what you do. I appreciate what you do. I don't believe what the reasons you're doing it are the same, but I'm here for you if you ever want to talk. You can't change people's minds. You can just give them information that allows them to change them themselves.
The email address is connecticut@ivaw.org. The website, www.ivaw.org/Connecticut. Jeff Bartos, a sergeant, a medic in the U.S. military, a veteran of the Iraq War, still working to help his fellow soldiers and bring about a speedy end to the Iraq and Afghan wars. Jeff Bartos, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We turn now to Denisa Yashari, a senior at Trinity College in Hartford and organizer of the Trinity College Anti-War Coalition. And she's here to talk about events coming up during the rest of October in Boston and other places. Denisa, I know you started out as a chemistry major.
You know, I did start out in the sciences, in biology and chemistry, and through the years, I have come to sort of have a career shift and a career change. So after I graduate, I will probably be doing more active things around anti-war and probably be looking for other things as opposed to sciences. So that's, I guess, the impact that the movement in the United States, it has had on my personal life choices. I would rather be organizing students for an anti-war march, especially now for October the 17th March and rally in Boston, than spending 4 hours in a chemistry laboratory.
And why don't you tell us what's happening on October 17th that you're working on today?
On October the 17th in Boston at Poplar Square at 1 p.m., there's going to be a regional anti-war march and rally. And Boston is going to be one of 30 cities in the nation that will have anti-war actions on that date. And October the 17th is a national day for local and regional actions, and it's actually a date that came out of the National Assembly to end the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan that met in Pittsburgh in July. So actions are going to be going on around the country in New York and in Washington on that very same date. People in the United States, like the rest of us in Connecticut and in Massachusetts, who feel the same way about the wars, who feel that these wars are immoral and unjust, are going to be voicing those opinions in the streets. And I encourage all students and workers and everybody else to come down to one of our buses. There's a bus from CCSU who is leaving on October the 17th. There's buses and vans that are leaving from Trinity College. We're organizing transportation from Connecticut, including Connecticut Students Against the War and Trinity Anti-War and CCSU. And I'm sure that many campuses around are also organizing students for October the 17th.
And your press release says there's information about this at the Connecticut Students Against the War website, ctsaw.org, and we'll link to this information at our website, talknationradio.org. Denisa, we've just spoken with Jeff Bartos about the work of Iraq Veterans Against the War. What are your thoughts about both the student anti-war movement and a movement that's similar, really, anti-war soldiers?
I think it's a wonderful thing. I think that the resistance of soldiers is an inspiring thing. I mean, we can look at the case of Victor Agosto, who refused orders to deploy to Afghanistan. And it's important for us to realize that the resistance of soldiers everywhere needs a strong and massive and broad anti-war movement here at home to support them. I think that the resistance of soldiers and anti-war movement go hand in hand. I think that one strengthens the other. And I think that, you know, if we realize that and if we show the support that these soldiers need to deploy orders, if they know, you know, that they're not alone, that there's a movement here to support them, that's the only way that we will be able to stop these wars. We have to create a movement that is massive and broad in the streets, that is independent of the politics of Washington.
And are you seeing a lot of interest at Trinity College and other places, students and the general public, maybe more interested in making the connection between war and problems with the economy or money for education?
I'm increasingly, including on my own campus, students and everybody else becoming more aware and losing hope in Obama. And these are the same people and students who celebrated his election, who took out to the streets and the dorms of our campus to celebrate it in hopes that things would change. They're realizing things aren't changing and that they won't change unless all of us take an active role in making sure that they do. So the majority of Americans is affected by the crisis, the increasing unemployment rate, the increasing tuition fees for students. You know, students who are graduating now, who are seniors, are going to have a very hard time finding a job. And the rest of them who are graduating and who have taken out loans are going to have a really hard time paying them back. But that is exactly why students at Berkeley had a walkout. You know, they had a walkout in face of increasing fees by 32% against the cutbacks to services and classes, against faculty and staff, the layoffs. And I think that the crisis, because it's not slowing down, more people are going to make that connection. And I hope that after they make that connection, they will realize that the best way to combat all of this is for all of us, the majority of us who feel the same way, to take out to the streets, you know, carry a banner that says, stop these wars, bring our troops home now. Use that money for funding and education, not for wars and occupations.
We'll hear more from student peace organizer Denisa Yashari and from other students from Israel and America in the coming weeks. We'll also be hearing from journalist Dar Jamail talking more about the GI resistance movement as we head into Veterans Day 2009. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program produced in Storrs, Connecticut. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions. Write to us at TalkNationRadio@gmail.com.